The topic of the class is Shabbos, creation, Kabbalah, and infinity. And to try to describe why this is the topic would probably take the next hour or so. But instead, let me just go into the topic itself and try to see a number of things about Shabbos. When we look at the liturgy, the prayers of the Shabbos, we see something, a number of different moments in time, which are the focus. For example, you look at the prayers on the Friday night. It talks about the moment of creation. It talks about Shabbos as a result of creation. If we go further and look at Shabbos morning, look at the prayers which are said in the morning, the focus of the prayers are no longer creation, rather the focus of the prayers have become Mount Sinai, the revelation at Sinai. We look at Shabbos afternoon and we find that the focus of the prayers is towards the future, is an eschatological dream, and it's a hope or a prayer towards the point in time when we will be one with God. Ata echad v'shimcha echad. You are one and your name is one. There's a fourth element about Shabbos, which also needs to be taken into consideration, and that is that all the laws about Shabbos are derived out of the building of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, this temple which was in the desert. And later, when they entered in, the Jews entered into Israel, it was the pre-Beit HaMikdash or the pre-temple. And what I want to do is just simply to ask, when I've stated facts till now, talked about creation, talked about Mount Sinai, and talked about the future, talked about the temple, the Mishkan. The question, though, is why? What is the connection between Shabbos and these things? If, for example, the laws of Shabbos are to be derived from the concept of a temple, we have to ask ourselves, why? What is there about this connection? Where does it come from? What does it teach us? But in order to start, we have to go back to the beginning, and try to go in order, and let's look what creation is. The first idea of Shabbos is a commemoration to the experience of creation. What I want to do is leave the theological realm for a moment and move over to the realm of science. In science, what is creation? At this point in time, as we end the 20th century, the scientific community has come to the conclusion that there indeed was a beginning. The reason why there is believed to be a beginning is because there is a discernible expanding universe. If the universe is expanding, then the implication would be that if you were to go backward in time, the universe would be contracting. It would contract and contract and contract and contract to the point that everything would be compressed into one thing. The moment before that is what we call the moment immediately preceding the Big Bang. The moment when this one thing explodes or begins to expand is the moment which is called the Big Bang. And that's from a scientific perspective. If one were to challenge a scientist and to ask, what was there the moment before the Big Bang? What was that before the Big Bang? The normal answer would simply be nothing. That the Big Bang is the beginning of something. What does it begin? It begins time, space, and matter. The point that we call the Big Bang is when matter begins, when time begins, and when space begins. So then when one goes back and asks the question, what was there before the Big Bang, the response remains nothing, but logically there's a difficulty with that nothing. Because we all understand very well that nothing is unable to give birth to something. So therefore we're forced to say that the nothing which pre-existed the Big Bang, if I can coin a term, must have been pregnant nothing. Because again, if there was simply nothing, then something cannot result out of nothing. It would remain nothing. But by the virtue of the fact that we see something, that means, where did that come from? The reason why the scientist says there was nothing beforehand, because what is that nothing which they're describing? It's nothing in terms of something, correct? It's nothing in terms of what we're aware of. It's nothing in terms of physics. This thing which is there before there is time is not simply on a timeline before time. It's something which exists on a completely different plane. It's outside of the realm of time, something which transcends time. And the same in terms of matter, and the same in terms of space. The existence before the Big Bang is an existence which transcends what we know of. Scientists have a difficulty with this because a scientist can only explain data which is in front of them. For a scientist to try to explain the data, which is obviously not in front of them, which is prior to what is in front of them, the scientist is frustrated. Now, one way of dealing with that frustration is simply to ignore it. Another way of dealing with the frustration is a beautiful quote which I came upon, page 3 of the handouts. It was authored by a man by the name of Robert Jastrow, who was the head of the Goddard Space Observatory for NASA. He was also professor of geology at Columbia University, New York. And listen to his description of this phenomenon. Scientists cannot bear the thought of a natural phenomenon which cannot be explained, even with unlimited time and money. There is a kind of religion in science. It is the religion of a person who believes that there is order and harmony in the universe, and every event can be explained in a rational way as a product of some previous event. Every effect must have its cause. There is no first cause. Einstein wrote, "The scientist is possessed by the sense of universal causation," unquote. This religious faith of the scientist is violated by the discovery that the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics are not valid, and as a product of forces or circumstances we cannot discover. When that happens, the scientist has lost control. If he really examined the implications, he'd be traumatized. As usual, when faced with trauma, the mind reacts by ignoring the implications. In science, this is known as, quote, refusing to speculate, or trivializing the origin of the world by calling it the Big Bang, as if the universe were a firecracker. Now, we would like to pursue that inquiry farther back in time, but the barrier to further progress seems insurmountable. It's not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, or another theory. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. This frustration which Jastrow over here is trying to describe is when a scientist realizes that I just simply cannot explain that nothing which is there. And logically, that thing before creation is not simply nothing. So let's use it as the term which I used before, pregnant nothing. But let's go a little bit further with creation to try to understand what creation is. What was there the moment before creation? We're getting a little tired of simply saying nothing. It's something which is outside of time, outside of space, and outside of matter. What is another way of calling that? Or infinite. Something which is in no way, shape, or form limited or has any parameters. The term for that is infinity, which means that the moment of creation is the moment when finite matter begins to exist. That moment, and I can't call it a moment even, that concept before there is time, before there is matter, you could call it antimatter, but that again is a definition, is a negative definition based upon what exists. It's something which seems to exist just simply on a completely different plane. Now, I want to just ask a little mathematical and philosophical question. If we were to take infinity and add something finite to infinity, what would be the sum total? Infinity plus finite equals? Remains infinite. Why is a philosophical question? Infinity plus finite is unaffected. Infinity, not zero plus finite. It's not zero plus finite. Infinity, when you add something finite to infinity, it remains infinite. The infinite is in no way... The infinite in no way is affected by the finite. Okay? Now, this observation mathematically is not that challenging. Philosophically, though, it begins to challenge us very much. Because if infinity plus finite remains infinite, what does that say about our present existence?
We're infinite
What does it say about our existence? Existentially, we all think that we exist. But we only exist in as much as we choose to focus upon the finite. Once we go ahead and we juxtapose the finite existence, quote unquote, with the infinite, which logically and philosophically and mathematically preceded the finite, again, I wouldn't say preceded, transcends the finite, caused the finite to come into existence, what it begins to mean is that perhaps what we seem to feel existentially is an illusion. Judaism had to deal with this incredible difficulty because we seem to think that we exist. And right now all of us feel existence. Once we realize that there is something infinite which is transcending our existence, we realize once we put ourselves next to this infinite, our existence by definition becomes a non-existence because real existence is the infinite. Because what we have in reality is infinite. Then at some point, at some time, in some place, finite emerges, but that doesn't affect the infinite. The infinite is unaffected by it. Which means that when we look at the larger picture, we come to the philosophical conclusion that our existence is extremely tenuous. Now, I'm not going to argue with the fact right now that every single one of us feel this existence. We feel that we're right here. The Talmud, in fact, has a beautiful description of this whole process. The experiential process. If you were to somehow communicate with a fetus, somehow communication between humans and a fetus could be organized, and you would go and tell the fetus, listen, what you think is existence right now is not really existence. It's only a pre-existence. The fetus would say, what are you talking about? I feel that this is existence. This is what it's about. I mean, again, the conversation seems almost like an absurdity, but look at the fetus. The fetus, everything is taken care of. It's being nourished. It's nice and warm. Nice room temperature. I mean, everything is great. And how would, if the fetus could conceptualize, how would it experience the onset of birth? It becomes a little bit tighter. Things begin to shake around. This downward motion towards the birth canal begins. And next thing that the fetus would experience would be his head being extremely crushed as it goes out through the birth canal. And the next thing, and what would, again, if the fetus could describe this, conceptualize it, what would it think was happening? That's the end of its existence. It's about to die. It comes out the other end. It sees this incredible light. Have you ever seen a room where most people are given birth, at least in modern times? Incredible light. The next thing that happens, it's smacked across the backside and someone says, Mazel Tov. But what you have right there, this fetus thinks that it just now died. But what happened was, in reality, it went from a pre-existence to an existence. So Judaism just goes and continues. Let's go a little bit further. And a person then lives through their life. They live through their 80, 90, 120 years. And then towards the end, the bodily functions begin to cease, and the breath becomes harder and harder to take, and the heart is not working like it once did. And as you experience this, you are convinced that you are dying. And as you take that last breath, that last gasp for air, suddenly you lose consciousness. And then you go into a place which is very, very light, and you get smacked on the backside again, and they say, Mazel Tov, now you've come into real existence. And this is what the Talmud says, is that you had thought the whole time that this was it, this is where it's at, that this is existence. That doesn't work if you have an infinite creator. That means that the whole question of existence is going to be somewhat skewed according to what our perception is. Okay? And that is how the Talmud deals, at least on one level philosophically, with this question. The ramifications of this are outstanding. It means that if a person were to live their entire existence based upon the here and now, they're basing their existence upon an illusion, upon factors which in reality are not necessarily all that important. If a person bases their experience on how much flesh they can ingest, or how much flesh they can do other things with and the like, on how much they can take advantage of other people. I mean, people have all sorts of funny ideals and goals in life, but a person bases them exclusively on an existence in the here and now, at the moment of quote-unquote death, when they come in contact with the infinite, what takes place at that point? There will be a profound sense of lack of connection. Because what you had is that you lived your whole life alienated from reality. You lived in an illusion. On the other hand, a person can live their life trying to go step by step and to relate with the infinite. From a Jewish religious perspective, this is the reason why we do mitzvot. This is the reason why we do commandments. What we're trying to do is simply to connect to the infinite. What we want to do is have a relationship with the infinite. Because then at the point of what we consider death, what we then have still is a relationship with the infinite. So in a sense, once you understand the philosophical backdrop, you understand why Judaism says to live the life as it does. But there's another problem. This other problem is more of a philosophical problem. I stated as a point of fact that the infinite coexists with the finite, or allows the finite to coexist with itself. How does that happen? Mathematically, we've tried to deal with it, but philosophically, how can something infinite allow something finite to coexist? Once you're putting limitations within the infinite, excuse me? There are no limitations of the infinite. What we sometimes get fooled is that we look at infinity as purely a mathematical construct. As a purely mathematical construct, then you could have some types of limitations within it. But as a philosophical construct, infinity simply has no limitations. The question then has become, this is a classic Jewish question as well, how could something infinite allow something finite to coexist? Just technically, what are the dynamics of such a relationship? How does this take place? How does infinity allow a finite coexistence? And the answer to this, in terms of Jewish mysticism, in terms of the Kabbalah, has been something which is called Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum means a contraction, a self-limitation. That, as it were, what it's trying to express is that infinity holds itself back, limits itself momentarily, whatever that may mean, and allows something to coexist with it. That being the case, we may have been tempted to say a moment earlier that if a person spends their whole existence not relating to the infinite, the moment that they die, you could have simply said they cease to exist. Because they had no connection with the infinite. But now that you see that philosophically, when infinity makes place for the finite, what we can say conceptually then is that we exist perhaps despite wanting to exist or not wanting to exist, God allows us to exist, and once we exist, we then go on and exist perhaps forever. But again, to the extent that we're relating to the infinite, which then may be something even more challenging, that at the point when you die, if you had no relationship with the infinite, you're still there in some sort of, a juxtaposition with the infinite, but simply feeling this complete inability of having any type of relationship. That's the philosophical conclusion of that. But if all this is the case, we could begin then to understand something very profound about Judaism and about creation. You know, maybe when we were kids, or when we didn't want to think about it in a more sophisticated manner, God becomes something for us like this comic book hero. He's a little bit bigger and stronger and more efficient than all the other comic book heroes, but he's like this comic book hero. And how does that creation take place in our minds? God is sitting around for a millennium or two, trying to think about how you go about creating, and finally tries it. Maybe it works the first time, maybe not. The second, third, and you have a series of creations till it actually works out. But if you're going to begin to think about what we've been saying, something infinite, in order for it to create, what does it have to do? Does it have to sit around and think about it and gather all of its resources? It's quite the opposite. Creation is the result of the infinite holding back. That very first moment of creation, the Big Bang, if you will, the very first moment of creation, you have infinity. I don't know what scientific term to use for this. I get a little afraid of trying to mix science with theology. You want to call it a black hole? You want to call it antimatter? I don't know what to call it. At the moment of creation, what you have is infinity holding itself back, as it were, allowing something to coexist with it. Which means that the Jewish, certainly the Kabbalistic understanding of creation has always been, creation isn't a pouring forth of God's strength, quite the opposite. Creation is God pulling back his strength, holding back and allowing something to coexist. That's the first day of creation, the first moment of creation. We go through the first day. We get to the second day. God is holding back yet more. The third day, God is holding more. The fourth day, God is holding. The fifth, finally, the sixth day, we get to the creation of man. And God is holding back and creates something which is said to be in his image. The degree at this point of holding back, because you look at this thing which is said to be in his image, and you think now you can understand God. You think that you look at man and we see something godly. But all this comes from God holding back, pulling the reins tighter and tighter, allowing something to coexist. What happens on the Shabbos? What happens on that first Sabbath? What does God do after 6 days of holding back? On the seventh day, God ceases to hold back. He lets go. And that's Shabbos. Shabbos, therefore, becomes, if this is not a contradiction in terms, a moment of infinity. That's what Shabbos is. God is no longer creating. God is no longer holding back. God reverts back to the way that it was the moment before creation. Now let's think it through. Think about the Bible. The Bible says creation took place when? In the evening or in the morning? What does the text say? And it was evening and it was morning one day. What comes first? The evening. When did creation take place? On that first Saturday night. That first Saturday night is when creation takes place. The moment when infinity stops and allows something to coexist. Shabbos, of course, being the day of infinity. In fact, the Jerusalem Talmud actually implies this particular analysis when it tells us, during the Havdalah service, one of the things that we use is a candle. What's the reason for using a candle? So one of the main reasons which is said is because Adam, on the first Saturday night, which means after a whole week of creation, his first Saturday night, Adam discovers or invents fire. As a commemoration to this, every Saturday night we make fire to show man's creativity, and it's interesting. Man now is going to go and live the second week, and man is going to go reach out. Man makes fire the second week, but if man is an image of God, what did God do in that first Saturday night? And this is what the Jerusalem Talmud tells us. If you look on the bottom of the first page, on the left side, it says, we do not say a blessing on the fire till we make use of its light. That when you want to make the blessing on the Havdalah candle, you first look at your fingers. You look at your fingers in the light of the candle, in the light of the candle, and then you make the blessing. So again, we do not say the blessing on the fire till we make use of its light. Rabbi Zeira, the son of Rabbi Abahu, derived from the verses, and God saw the light was good. And after that it says, Vayavdil, God distinguished between light and darkness. Vayavdil meaning Havdalah. The first God looked at the light, and then God went about and made this distinction. Which means the very concept of making Havdalah on a Saturday night at 5, where is it coming from? It's coming what God did at the very first moment of creation, when God creates light. But hold it, the God creating light was on the very first day. But think it through. The very first moment of creation was what? It was a Saturday night. What Adam then eventually does on the second Saturday night is just existing in a microcosm of God as God creates the first Saturday night by creating light. Adam then creates light on the second Saturday night. But of course, Saturday, or Shabbos as it were, transcends time. Which really means that the moment before the first creation, the moment before the first act of creation, is identical to the moment after 6 days of creation. Do you see that? Because before creation begins, God is infinite. God holds back and allows a coexistence. The second day, more coexistence. The third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth. We get to the sixth day, God stops holding himself back, so God reverts back to infinity, as it were. Which means that what the Shabbos is simply connecting to God on his terms, the way that God truly is, outside of time, outside of space, and outside of matter. What Shabbos is all about, then, is connecting to reality. Connecting to infinity, connecting to what real existence is supposed to be about. Okay, you've been very patient. Go ahead.
Some contradiction, I don't know, but first I have to back up something you mentioned earlier. You said that for the team to you said that infinity wasn't valid because infinity has no boundary. And I view that as a messing up with the semantics. You say infinity has no boundary, you say it's not enclosed, whatever, it's infinite. But in theory, a part of infinity, if
When something is infinite, could it be infinitely large or infinitely small?
Yeah, okay.
So that when you're talking, again, the problem that we're having right now, the problem that we're having is when we go from the mathematical definition of infinity to the philosophical definition of infinity. No, perhaps. Like, for example, I can call something infinite even though it's limited. By God, I can't do that. I could.
One of the rules of mathematics is that between these two points is an infinite amount of lines. But so therefore, I have an example of infinity, which is quite limited. Here is an infinity, which is not God. I'm not saying that of course God is infinite, therefore every infinity is God. No. So I'm saying that's the difficulty of trying to work out the mathematical idea over here.
Well, that's infinity in the sense you have to add up a whole bunch of numbers and you end up at a finite result. So that in a sense is still finite. Certainly infinity. No, it's a contradiction I want to point out with that. You said that at the end of 16 God lets himself go and he just goes back to space and on infinity. That means we're still here and we shouldn't be here anyway.
That means we should or we shouldn't be here.
We shouldn't, because as soon as he goes back, then you say when God fills everything,
right,
that means we can't get to have the final. So he goes back, there are creatures, and that's what's keeping us sick.
Right. Right.
But the seventh day, you say, oh, he filled something, so I wasn't able to tell. And that's the seventh day of birth to the other scale of reference.
It obviously, when we're going to talk about God, we're going to have difficulty talking about God within our 6 or 7 day week. I'm trying to explain philosophically what are the ramifications of creation and where the Shabbos fits in. If philosophically creation means God holding back, we get to the end of creation, God is no longer holding back. So you're saying, so do we really exist? Do we exist or don't we exist? So that exactly is the dilemma. This is what Simpson tries to explain and says, well, we do exist and we don't exist, and it depends how you want to look at it. We do exist and we don't exist. It depends how you want to look at it. If you choose, let's put it this way. If you look at this existence and you think this is what it is, this is a reality, then you're making a mistake. If you realize that this quote unquote reality, which we are experiencing, I want to stress that word experiencing, is existence because of God holding back. So now what you will ask then is, so what happens on Shabbos? So what happens on Shabbos? We get to the seventh day, now what happens? So what happens? So what happens then on Shabbos? So now of course we're on this world over here. So let's go on now. We're in this world. We feel an existence. We get to Shabbos. So what do the laws say? Now let's think a little bit. For 6 days of the week, God created by virtue of holding back. We are in the image of God. When you hear the word image, what comes to your mind? A mirror. Which means that a mirror, you often see the opposite. Correct? So. Listen. What you see by image, when you say we are in God's image, this does not mean you look at man and you see physically an identical being to God. That's not what it means. We are in God's image. It's something which is, perhaps it could be a mirror image, it could be something which is, even though it emanates from it, but it could be a complete opposite. When you look at your image in the mirror, you see the opposite of yourself. You don't see yourself. The word image, what I'm trying to show you, does not mean an identical being. It doesn't mean an identical being. Does it? Does it mean identical being? You're falling right into it. You're saying, listen to what you're saying. You're saying chronological doesn't work. Doesn't work when talking about who? Doesn't work when talking about who? When talking about God, it doesn't work. Correct. God transcends time, and therefore it's starting to talk about God in terms of time. We're going to have a difficulty with it. If it's an existence, it is finite.
Okay. Well, okay, but we exist right now, 24 frame of reference, being That's our frame of reference. And in our discussion, the fact that we're talking about this, and should we recognize that we also recognize that theory coexists by arguments. And just the fact we're arguing about it is there, or if you argue about it or something like that.
That's absurd.
No, well,
just because you argue about something doesn't mean that it exists.
No, we're assuming it exists. We're trying to juxtapose our finite self with the infinite right now. That's our dilemma. How can we exist in the infinite? Okay, anyway, my point is, frame of reference, the point that we're here, and you say that we're in a finite sort of existence, non-existent. Even if we do this non-exist, our frame of reference in relation to God is infinite. That's right, it's finite. But if God already released himself, we shouldn't.
God, we don't.
So let's go a little bit further. You're getting caught up in language, you're getting caught up in trying in concepts and trying to understand how God relates to man. Now listen for a couple of minutes. Listen or not. Now listen for a couple of minutes and see how it flows through.
Yeah. What exactly happens with Jesus at the moment of creation?
In a sense, the first Saturday night and every Saturday night are the same. Yeah, in a sense.
And that's why we still think
like that. Right, right. It's a parallel. A parallel is created. So let's get back to the issue of man being in the image of God. The image does not mean an identical creature. The image means some sort of connection, some sort of relationship, but obviously it doesn't mean identical. God creates something from nothing, and that's creation. We talk about God. For 6 days of the week of the first creation, God is creating by holding back, and that creates something from nothing. That's how infinity creates. Man being finite creates in a very different manner. Being finite, we create by taking something finite and working with something finite, improving something which is finite, and that's considered to be creative for man. Which means that if God for 6 days of the week created by holding back and then stopped creating by letting go, man does quite the opposite, because man is in the image of God. Man for 6 days creates by going forth. Man creates 6 days by taking something and working with it. When we get to the seventh day, man stops creating by holding back. And what we have is a complete, again, the image of God, what we have is a complete parallel, but it's an opposite result. That means that the moment that we hold back on Shabbos is the moment that we thereby become like God. We're holding back from creation. Our 6 days of creation is not God's 6 days of creation. God's 6 days of creation are by holding back. Our 6 days of creation are by going forth. God's seventh day, day of infinity, is God not holding back and reverting back to the natural form of infinity. Man creates 6 days by going forth, and on the seventh day, man becomes godly by holding back. Okay, so now let's go back and let's look at the Siddur. Let's look at the prayer books. It says that it says on Friday night, what we're trying to do is we rest on the Sabbath, or we hold back on the Sabbath. Again, uvayom hashvi'i, on the seventh day, Shavat, we hold back, vayinofash. Rest is a result. Rest is not the order. Hold back. In modern Hebrew, shvita means a strike. Holding back work. Shavat. Seventh day, we hold back. But it says in the prayers that the Shabbos is Zecher L'Ma'aseh Bereishis. It's a remembrance for the act of creation. Which means that when we commemorate Shabbos, we're commemorating the act of creation. But the act of creation doesn't take place on Shabbos. The act of creation takes place when God is doing something, allowing something finite to take place. Which means that our holding back on Shabbos parallels the act of creation, the moment of creation, when God holds back. that by us keeping Shabbos, we are thereby paralleling, mirroring, imitating God's holding back and allowing creation to go forward by holding back. Of course, for 6 days, we go and we do work. But again, it's interesting. It doesn't say that the first Shabbos commemorates. It doesn't say that our Shabbos, commemorates the Shabbos. It says it commemorates the act of creation, Zecher L'Ma'aseh Bereishit. That it's a remembrance for the act of creation. The act of creation is by virtue of holding back. And that's what answers your question. That when it comes to our Shabbos, we have to be a mirror of God. So therefore, we don't create during the week by virtue of holding back. We create by doing things. God created by holding back. It comes to Shabbos, God let go. It comes to Shabbos, we hold back. By holding back, we come like, we become, as it were, like God by that moment of creation. Yeah. The second point, which we brought up initially, was the concept of Shabbos morning about Matan Torah, Revelation at Sinai. Now again, we perhaps would think that Revelation at Sinai is a moment when God actually reveals himself. Correct? If we were standing there by Mount Sinai, we would experience a revelation from God. We would experience God. We would know what God is. And here's where it begins to get challenging. We would know God, as it were. So it's not really God, of course. When I say it's not really God, I mean, let's delineate. There is God in all of its grandeur, and then there's God as far as the human mind is able to appreciate. In fact, let's look at a verse before I start this. Anyone know what? We have a word in Hebrew called kedusha, kadosh. What does kadosh mean? Holy. Okay, what does holy mean? What is the word holy itself? I mean, I know that we take for granted, not fit. What is holy? See, he's a holy man. You see, he's not physical. What does holy mean? Holy means. Holy means separate. Holy means to be separate. In fact, when you get to the part of Shemona Esrei where it says, Kadosh, 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 holy, 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 holy. What's the very next word? Meloch al aretz kevodo. But he fills all of existence. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh means separate, separate, separate is God. Completely, that statement of being transcendental. Completely beyond. Which is a basic philosophical difficulty. God is at one time completely infinite, beyond, Kadosh, 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 completely transcendental. On the other hand, but he fills all of creation. That means we're able to somehow experience God. But don't be fooled. When you experience God, don't think that you've just now experienced the transcendental. You've just had a touch of the transcendental. Let's look at the quote on the first page on the right side. It's from the rabbis in the Midrash. And this is describing the moment of revelation at Sinai. We will never find God's strength fully displayed towards any of his creatures, for he does not visit his creatures with burdensome laws, but comes to each one according to his strength. For know thou that if God had come upon Israel with the full might of his strength when he gave them the Torah, they would not have been able to withstand. As it says, if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, then we shall die. God, however, came upon them according to their individual strength. For it says, the voice of the Lord is with power. It does not say with his power, but with power. According to the power of each individual. Another explanation of the Almighty, we cannot find him excellent in power. When God said to Moses, make a tabernacle for me, he explained in amazement, the glory of the Holy One, blessed be he, fills heaven and earth. And yet he commands, make a tabernacle for me? Moreover, he saw prophetically that Solomon would one day build a temple much larger than the tabernacle, and yet would say to God, but will God in very truth dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded. If Solomon said this of the temple, which was so much greater than the tabernacle, then how much more could this be said of the tabernacle? For this reason did Moses say, O thou that dwellest in the covert, O Most High, which Rabbi Judah, the son of Rabbi Simon, explained, he who dwells in the covert is most high above all his creatures. And what does it mean by in the shadow of the Almighty? In the shadow of El, it does not say in the shadow of the merciful or in the shadow of the gracious one, but in the shadow of the Almighty. That means in the shadow which Bitzalel, He was the man who constructed the tabernacle. Constructed. For this reason, does not say, and abidest in the shadow of the Almighty. God said, not as you think, do I think. 20 boards on the north, 20 on the south, and 8 in the west suffices me. Moreover, I will descend and even confine my Shekhinah within one square cubit. What we just now had was two expressions in the Medrash which are extremely significant. One is the moment of Mount Sinai, the moment when God reveals himself, when you have what you would have thought was we're connecting with the transcendental, or perhaps we're experiencing the transcendental, the Medrash saying quite the opposite. What you experienced was not God in all of his glory, because if that would have been the case, you wouldn't have been able to succeed. Simply what God did is he contracted himself and gave enough for the people to be able to deal with. When it comes to building the tabernacle, the Medrash continues and says, do you think that you could confine God, as it were? He says, no, not at all. I will limit myself, contain myself, place myself within the tabernacle. Which means in one source in the Medrash, we already have the next two parts of the key, clues to the puzzle. Mount Sinai, again, parallels creation, inasmuch as at Mount Sinai you would have thought God just revealed himself, quite the opposite. At the moment of revelation that you were able to understand something, you realized, but you didn't see in all its grandeur what transcendental, being transcendental is all about. You saw a part, you saw something. You experienced God holding himself back and just giving you enough that you can connect to. That's what Mount Sinai is about. That means that the idea of Mount Sinai being mentioned on Shabbos, commemorating Mount Sinai, surely Mount Sinai is where God's voice goes forth and tells us about God, but there's something much more subtle. The subtlety is that voice going forth is not God in his essence. It's this little part of God which the human mind could deal with without self-destructing, without short-circuiting, without just causing a complete lack or ceasing to exist. Just one more source on the top of the left-hand side of the first page. The rabbis are trying to explain what it was like when God spoke in the tabernacle. And it says, from above the ark cover that was upon the ark of the testimony, what is the purpose of this text? Since it says elsewhere, and the Lord spoke unto him out of the tent of meaning. It might appear that he did so from any part of the interior. Hence, Scripture explicitly states, from above the ark cover that was upon the ark of the testimony. The Ark of the Testimony. If the text simply read from above the Ark cover, it might have appeared to mean from any part of the Ark cover. Scripture therefore states, from between the two cherubim, that a very specific place in the tabernacle was where the communication took place. This is the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Said Rabbi Shimon, the son of Azai, I do not wish to appear as though I were contradicting the words of my teacher, but only as supplementing his remarks. The All-Glorious is one of whom it says, do not I fill the heaven and earth, saith the Lord? And yet see to what lengths he went in his love of Israel. The same glory that was so vast compressed itself so as to appear to be speaking from above the ark cover between the two cherubim. What we have over here is, again, let's go back to the question. If I can stop in mid-sentence. We noticed that the laws of the Sabbath are derived out of the tabernacle. That doesn't answer the question. Why are the laws of the Sabbath derived out of the tabernacle? Why specifically the tabernacle should be connected with the Shabbos? Why the things I'm prohibited to do on Shabbos are derived out of the work which was done to construct the tabernacle? Because you would have thought that you're building a house of God. You would have thought that God will be contained in this house. You would have thought I can just go into the house and therein lies God. Quite the opposite is what the Medrash teaches us, the sages teach us. Quite the opposite. That the only way that God can actually abide in a place which is physical is by doing the act which is self-limiting. Which now we understand. All the laws on Shabbos are not things that I can't do and I have a capability of doing. For 6 days I'm creative. 6 days I go forth. The seventh day I want to be like God. So how will I be like God? By holding back. But holding back in terms of what? How will I know what things I have to hold back upon? So very good. The next time that we find that God is limiting himself, as it were, is within the construction of the tabernacle. Which means that the construction of the tabernacle of the Mishkan is a testimony to, again, an ongoing limitation of God. Which means, very simply, any time that you think that you've perceived God, realize what you've perceived is this issue of holding back. But if what we've done till now is try to show a philosophical understanding, I want to now show you, try to describe what I think are the ramifications of it. Because Judaism is not a religion that simply has nice philosophical concepts. This concept of holding back, tzimtzum, is philosophically valid. It thereby becomes a moral imperative. Let's go back in time, a very long time right now. 3,000 years, 4,000 years. Go back to the times of polytheism. What did polytheism preach? What was the concepts of polytheism? And I don't mean polytheism now simply in terms of its religious experience. I mean polytheism in terms of the society that it created. The society within a polytheistic system was one that, you know, it was said that if in Judaism man is created in the image of God, in polytheism the gods were created in the image of man, and very often within the lowest common denominator, which man had. What we see, all the gods in polytheism are limited. Why are they limited? Because none of them are infinite. Once you have more than one god, you're dealing with beings that are, by definition, limited. If each one of them are limited, what they're interested in is control, controlling various areas. So therefore, this concept of a god which is going out and trying to, you know, have this ego thing and trying to control others is what the polytheistic system encourages. So then what happens in terms of society? In the ancient societies, we find that who is considered to be a great individual, a person who can go out and can control as much as possible. Which means, and by the way, this is unfortunately still partially true today, if I can control 100,000 people, I'm considered to be a great warrior, or a very powerful individual. That's power. In Judaism, who is considered to be somebody who's powerful? See, no, it's you're off track. If in polytheism, a person can control 100,000 people, a million people, the person can only control 10,000 people, he's pretty good. If you control 100 people, you know, you're a leader of a small gang. You got 10 people that follow you, everything. So you're somewhat powerful. In Judaism, who is considered to be powerful? Ezahu Gibor, who is considered to be one of strength? Hakoveshet Yitzro, the person who practices self-limitation. Where does this come from? It comes from what we understand about God. We understand that for God to create, it wasn't God going forth. It was God holding back. Which means that in the ancient world, perhaps, a person would try to control as many people as possible. If I can control somebody else physically, economically, sexually, then you go ahead and do it. That's what gives you power. That's what empowers an individual. Judaism responded against this and says, first of all, there's only one God. And if there's only one God, that God is by definition infinite, because there is no other God that it's sharing its power with. If that one God is infinite, it has no needs. If it has no needs even further, creation process doesn't take place by virtue of this God trying to work something out, but it comes forth by God holding back. In Judaism, we want to be like God. So on Shabbos, what we do is we hold back. The reason why the Shabbos was considered to be something so precious, because at that moment we connect with infinity. At that moment we connect with God. We connect with this being that has no needs. The way that we go about doing it, the dynamic involved, is by holding back. How do we look? We look at the points into, we look at the tabernacle. We look how the tabernacle could only have resulted by God holding back. So therefore we hold back from those very things which are needed to make a tabernacle, that we understand the idea. We understand there's a complete absurdity in terms of that God's presence is within this building. It's only within the building if God is holding his power back, as it were. So this is what happens on the Shabbos. We hold back. But what happens during the week? Why is the Shabbos so important? It's because the laws of Shabbos, the rules of Shabbos, affect us in other areas as well. The goal is not simply, when the Shabbos rolls around, I stop. I gain self-control. The idea of the Shabbos, it is a lesson in self-control. Is it a lesson in being godly, which therefore has to affect me during the entire week as well? If during the Shabbos I held back from the creative activity, I'm doing things which I could have done, but I don't do because I want to be like God, what happens then when I go during the week and now it's time to conduct my business? I could take advantage of somebody financially. I'm in position to do it. I can do it in such a way that he'll never know it. I can do it in such a way that he can't do anything about it. And Judaism says, no, you have to be moral. Why do you have to be moral? Control yourself. Hold yourself back. Control your urges. Control this desire of controlling other people. Because within self-control is where godliness lies. Which means that the lessons of Shabbos are, in fact, a lesson for all of existence, for all the days of the week. It is the way that I will have relationships, personal relationships. I'm not going to dominate somebody just because I may be in a socioeconomic position to dominate someone. I will hold back my ego, hold back this desire of dominating others, and thereby I will again be godly within my relationships. Which is why Judaism was able to go so far as to say that a person who doesn't keep Shabbos, and you know what the law actually says? A person who doesn't keep Shabbos, non-existence. Because Shabbos is about real existence. It's about eternity. It's about infinity. Not keeping Shabbos is simply non-existence. That's the value involved. That is again, let's understand the dynamics of what the law is. What is it? Mos yumas. When it says that a person who doesn't keep the Sabbath, the law is that a person should die. In the Torah. The person deserves to die. But what does it mean he deserves to die? That doesn't mean that we're going to go running around and go looking at who's not keeping Shabbos and cutting their heads off. That's not what it is. The Torah teaches you values. It means that non-keeping of the Shabbos, the value of it is as if one has non-existence. What we then see is that the Shabbos is critical for Jewish behavior. I mean, I said earlier, our philosophical understandings have moral implications. We understand that God is the ultimate being which does hold back. That's how creation can be here. That's how we exist. That's how we experience our existence. On the other hand, let's not think that this is all that there is within existence. There is something else. That something else is the infinite which is beyond. What we want to do while we're on this earth is to connect to the infinite as much as possible. Our way of connecting to the infinite is to try to be godly. Is to try to do things like God does. The Shabbos is a lesson in being like God. That is what the Shabbos is, in very, very simple terms. It is a lesson. It is a lesson in self-control. It's not, let me take something which some people see as being absurd. And from the outside, it's difficult. I can't tear toilet paper on Shabbos. You know, like, it seems like such a simple thing. Well, tearing was actually one of the 39 categories of creative work that was done to build the tabernacle. But what does this do for me not to... Correct. It is something so small, something so benign, something which seems to be insignificant, yeah, and even on that, experience self-control. Practice self-control. Because if you can experience self-control on something minor, you will therefore be able to experience self-control on something which is more meaningful. Then that's what the Shabbos is about, a lesson in self-control. And as we experience the Shabbos, when we hold ourselves back, it is when we experience God. And ultimately, maybe this will help resolve some of the questions that came up earlier. The Kutzker Rebbe once asked, where is God? And his answer was, wherever you allow him to be. And that's the Jewish answer. I mean, God in terms of a geographical being, God transcends that. He transcends time, transcends space, transcends matter. The only ability that we have to speak of God is when we allow God to be someplace. How do we allow God to be there? One of the best ways is this whole issue of what the Shabbos is about, by holding back, by experiencing self-control, by not letting the Shabbos exist in an island, by letting the Shabbos be a motivation during the week as well, and let the Shabbos inspire me to how I will then conduct all of my other relationships, and how I conduct my business, and how I will treat my friends, and how I will treat my family. And that is what the message of what the Shabbos is.
That the measure of a person's godliness or holiness is their ability to refrain from action, to refrain from doing things.
In the proper context.
Well, what you're trying to do is to show that you can hold back in a sense. You can persist from doing sort of small things so that it comes out of control. When you come around to a more Eastern way of practicing religion where abstention from worldly things is the way of growing closer and more godlike, not the Jewish way of
Excellent question, which is why I understood the question. I said, within certain guidelines, within certain practices. Not that we hold back on everything. We look at the tabernacle. Why at the tabernacle? That's where we see God holding back in. Those areas we hold back. Other areas we don't. So as far as your particular question may go, in terms of abstinence, on Shabbos, quite the opposite is true. On Shabbos, it is actually considered to be a positive thing to have sexual relations, assuming that you're married. And it's assuming it's with your spouse. And I don't want to be implied that I said anything here that I didn't. But what happens mystically then? Mystically then, when there is a unity between two people, mystically, what the relations on Friday night is about is it connects between what the Jewish people are doing with God. We're interacting with God at that moment. And that is why within the Jewish mystical sources, it was said to be so important to have relations on Friday night. Because then it is simply a metaphor to what the entire Jewish community is doing with God. We are interacting with God. We are being with God. We're trying to be godly. Okay? Dealing here with one particular paradigm. There are other things which are involved as well. When you do a mitzvah during the week, you're doing it, but what's a mitzvah? God commanded it. Why did God command it? That means by virtue of doing this mitzvah, you are thereby connecting to God because you're doing His will. By doing God's will, therefore, that you're getting a moment of infinity. And you know what? Let's just take this idea a little bit further because so many people are confused about this. I mean, is God sitting up there in heaven with little gold stars? You know, oh, you came to discovery this week, gold star. You know, oh, you did that, give you a demerit. I mean, what does it mean to do a mitzvah? That when a person does a mitzvah, they've changed the reality of who they are. That mitzvah changes them, causes them to have an ability to connect to God in a more profound way. And that's what in schar mitzvah mitzvah. The reward for mitzvah is the mitzvah. Don't expect God as a little gold star up there. It's much more profound than that. It's that by virtue of doing something good, you've just now uplifted yourself. You've improved yourself. By doing something negative, what you've done is you've distanced yourself from God in a way. Of course, what we are made up is of hundreds of thousands of actions and things which purify us and hundreds of thousands of things which alienate us from God. And that's the sum total of what a human life is. At the point of death, then we connect to God based upon the reality of who we are. It's not that God takes out the calculator and starts adding up, okay, 475 commandments. No, again, it's not what happens. It is basically a reality of who this individual is, which as I said yesterday, that the reality of who you are is completely up to free will, up to what you decide. The fact that you did something yesterday doesn't mean that it has to be a permanent, indelible part of you. That a person can take something and completely eradicate that from their existence. They can take it off. When you do that, the process of doing that is what's called tshuva. Change the past. Change the future. Change who you are. Change the relationship. Yeah.
Why do you do it with God? Change yourself.
What we want to constantly do is, again, by doing one mitzvah, you've changed yourself somewhat.
Why do you have to work on that for it to keep it? Change yourself should be a permanent change.
It should be. The question is, has it become a permanent change? If I give charity once, am I now a charitable individual? You say, oh no, I've done that one. So you're going back to the check. You got the check. Okay, I did that. I'm asking you, is that you? Are you a charitable person? Now, it could be. But once you do it once, you never have to do it again the rest of your life. But it depends if you've been an opportunity to do it. If you're in, one second, stop. If you're an opportunity to be charitable and yet you're not charitable, that means you're no longer a charitable person. That means that you've missed an opportunity. And therefore, by missing the opportunity, now you've changed. Now you've become a person that is not all that charitable. Again, the reality of who you are is going to be based upon things that you do and things that you don't do. Yeah.
Why is it that Shabbos is chosen as a time for creation? Why not during the week? Hold back during the week, the whole week.
I think it goes back to the issue of being in the image of God.
We have to hold back during the week, so why?
But it's a different type of holding back. Shabbos, what we're trying to do is to be like God. In a profound way. All week we want to be like God, but Shabbos is a much more profound way. So we want to be like God is in reality, and that is infinity. It is the day where we connect with infinity.
Why is it
such
that because God finished creation on Shabbos,
that's a very... No, it's not contradicting it. You just have to understand what that means on a deeper level. You have to understand what it means for God to do work and what it means for God to hold back. God, it means you have to think.
You're holding back for God and letting
go. Right. You have to understand.
It's not doing it to compliment. You're doing it to be an image. When you say that we don't do more of our job, God is great, we didn't do work. That's saying that we're doing duplicate.
Again, we cannot be God.
Right. Why is it necessary
that we can't be God?
We don't do work, because
God's right. So that happens to be true, but it's a lower level of understanding it, and it happens not to be what's focused on in the Siddur. Zeich l'maaseh bereishis. This is going to be something which remembers about the act of creation. Yeah. Go ahead. By the way, this is not what I would call the easiest topic in the world. This is a difficult topic. Especially when you're tired and tired. No, these ideas, which are really based upon deep thoughts within Jewish mysticism, and the whole concept of tzimtzum is a basic contradiction within itself, and you have to work it all the way through to see how it does in fact work. Go ahead.
What happened to 6 days?
I've heard the question already. Yeah.
If I understand correctly, I'm simplistic understanding is that Shabbos God is creating.
I'm not saying no. I'm just saying it's deeper than that.
Okay, so it's deeper than that.
That's true.
In a sense, in order to take an infinite being and limit the infinite being so as to be able to be comprehended by us finite people on earth and not blow us away, God had to actually hold back in a sense. To not reveal everything in its full power and extent and glory, we would not have been able to comprehend it.
Right.
Too much for us.
True.
So now we see through that act that God had the capacity to do that, and therefore we seek to emulate that on Shabbos, because we learn that we can, by doing that, we can actually grow more holy, more spiritual, more elevated by learning to abstain in that thing. And then carry that through the public history journey. Is that the essence of the
absolutely
right now? The fulcrum that argument rests on an understanding that God persisted because or limited itself. And if you go back to that diagram you drew there,
yeah.
This is where I have a problem. Do you agree that those two lines mark finite points on the board?
Yes.
Yet you can have an infinite amount of space between.
Correct. Them. Correct.
There is a perfect example of infinity and infinity coexisting.
Right.
Without the need for the infinity to be restricted in any way.
Correct.
Because the infinity has no beginning and end within that space.
Correct.
So why would it be any form of restriction for Shem to come down in the earth in exactly the same way? Let's say, just to keep it metaphorical, the tabernacle was two walls.
Yes.
You could contain the whole of Hashem in there without any problem because of the intimacy that fit into that space.
Right.
So,
excuse me?
Linear.
Correct.
So what I'm saying is I no longer see the restriction on the infinite. I start with
it. I know. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't have showed you this. This is a mistake in infinity. And this is a mistake in infinity. This is...
This and this are not infinite.
No, they're finite.
The fact is that numerically... Literally, you can have an infinite number of lines over here.
Exactly.
This is not the sort of infinity that God is. There is a quantum leap, 20 quantum leaps. It's completely different between what God is infinity versus this type of infinity.
I said it earlier, I'll say it again, see if this helps at all. If just because God is an infinite, it doesn't mean that every infinity is God. Right? And that, in terms of logic, that's clear. Just because Shakespeare is a man doesn't mean that you are Shakespeare because you are a man, right? That's false logic. It's really what you're doing here. You're saying, I have an example of infinity, which exists within finite, so therefore all infinity must actually exist within finite. No, I'm saying there's a different sort of infinity, just like there's a different sort of man. Shakespeare is a different man than you. Do you understand what I'm saying? So therefore, don't get fooled by this type of example, because this is based upon numbers, and numbers work this way. But when I talk about God in terms of being a being which is infinite, when you say God is inside that temple, do you mean to tell me for a moment that God is only inside that temple? Do you mean to say for a moment that all of existence aside from that is free of God? No, you don't mean that, but in this example you would say that. Because in this example you're saying, this infinite number of lines is within this place. That means that this something has nothing to do with it. Okay? The back of, right, right. And what does that mean?
On his level,
exactly.
As much as he could take in. And if the rest of the Jewish people were at a lower level, they couldn't even take in that much.
Exactly. What does it mean, the back? It means that after things happen, I can perceive God in something. That's a very high level. But even that, that's not the same as anticipating. Under, if you really know somebody, can anticipate their actions. Moses was able to do that. Moses was able, after something happened, to see the image that God left in something. The cleft of the rock is what is the example. What you gave is the example that the Talmud actually gives. How the Talmud explains it. In the Talmud and Brachot, the Bible itself actually talks about the cleft in the rock. They've got to make an image in a rock, and after it's gone by, then Moses will understand it. But that's after the fact. That's not that you would not in any way, shape, or form call real knowledge. What I've been trying to do is something very simple, and yet extremely difficult, to try to get real with the idea of infinity. Realize that philosophically it is there. There is something infinite there. If you're simply going to walk out at the end of the day and say, well, you know what, I believe that there could be something, all that we know, the Big Bang happened from nothing. That's a very lame, philosophically, that's a very lame explanation. That there was simply nothing there. Because nothing does not create something. Once you understand that there's something which is outside of all the rules that we understand, something which is completely transcendental, you'll understand what infinity is and what God is about. Again, conceptually, not practically. Once you've gone that far, then you have to start talking about what does creation really mean? What does connection to God really mean? What is existence in reality? Go ahead.
Each one of them was part of this totality, not a part of it, I would think. A little bit like if I stare into the sun, I can be blinded with intense. I put in a lot of layers of sunglass, like the sea, a whole of the sun's ball, but I would still not be intense. In other words, the modulation can be turned down. Is it that way, or is it the thing like just see a little?
It's the latter, but let me just tell you a parallel understanding. Maimonides says that Moses understood what took place at Mount Sinai. Again, after something happened, Moses understands. All the other people just experienced Mount Sinai. But for Moses, it was an intellectual experience. For the masses, it was an emotional experience. They experienced God. Now what does this mean? They experienced something beyond. They experienced something which they never experienced before, at least not that type of... that much strength to it. It was something which was beyond any other experience, and they experienced God, but it didn't take place up here. It took place experientially.
I have a problem with that.
Go ahead.
Even in mankind, the physical world is modeled on the spiritual world. Within us, every cell has got that DNA, any cell has
But isn't it dependent upon how that's developed?
Yes.
So that's exactly the point. It's not that no one else had a capability of being like Moses, but no one else had developed it. Let me just say one thing. What does the verse say? They all saw what? They all saw what? What's the next word? No. They all saw the voice of God. What does it mean to see the voice of God? That means perception. They perceived something about God. They experienced God. That doesn't mean understanding. That means an experience. Okay, now you understand what Maimonides is saying. Is that God, is that Moses, he hears it. The other people, maybe each person on their level, is experiencing something. And there is an objectified thing called God. But don't you think, just because you experienced God just now by Mount Sinai, that now you know what God is. Now you have a complete understanding of it. In fact, the opposite is true. And this is, of course, the frustration. The more we tend to know about God, the less we know. The more you understand, the more you'll see that you understand it even less. And that the gulf between us is even more and more and more. You can begin the day thinking, you know, God is just this big, happy guy up there. You know, I can connect to him. And the more you understand what God really is, you understand the gulf between us. Man and God is absolutely impossible to ever close. But what we can do is one thing, and that's try to emulate God, to be like God, to be godly. Okay.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.